Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the ongoing crisis in Haiti deepens as COVID-19 continues its spread there, and as government-backed paramilitary thugs are yet again on a rampage in the La Saline and City Soleil sections of Port-au-Prince, the nation's capital. The man leading the charge in these massacres is known by international agencies and the U.S.-backed Haitian government for having participated in massacres in 2019. But nevertheless, he remains on the street. And the United States is threatening to deport a former Haitian death squad leader, Emmanuel Tonto Constant, back to Haiti. He remains a wanted man in Haiti. He had fled Haiti to the United States to avoid facing justice. But in the United States, he was arrested. He was caught in fraud schemes and sentenced to prison. But now, the Trump administration wants to return him to Haiti despite an outcry from Haitians and human rights organizations. The present U.S.-backed Haitian government is said to be friendly towards Constant. And we mark the anniversary of the bombing of Earth First environmentalists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney. They were injured when a pipe bomb that had been placed in their car exploded. And for this week's Campaigners for Black Lives, yet another black man dead at the hands of police, this time in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And what is going on in Los Angeles as Black Lives Matter LA press forward on their demands to limit the power of LAPD? And our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Thousands of demonstrators marched in Minneapolis last night to protest the death in police custody of African-American George Floyd the previous night. They clashed with police who fired tear gas and flashbang devices. Floyd died after a white police officer kneeled on his neck while Floyd moaned and pleaded he couldn't breathe. His brother Filonese appeared on CNN.
They could have tased him. They could have mazed him. Instead, they put their knee in his neck and just sat on him and didn't care at all. He screamed, "Mama, mama, I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And they just didn't care. So I just don't understand.
The officer who kneeled on Floyd's neck and the three others who looked on and failed to intervene to save Floyd's life were all fired yesterday by Minneapolis Police Chief Medario Arredondo.
I've been obviously up all night and reviewing the information that I have to make the decision that I'm standing before you today with many of the community leaders behind me. Before involved former employees, I've made that decision this afternoon.
The chief said the police department would conduct a full internal investigation and prosecutors will decide whether to file criminal charges against the officers involved. Steve Belton of the Urban League pointed to the three officers who stood by and did nothing.
And then the further cowardice of the three officers who facilitated that by not once intervening. They have an obligation under the department's own rules to intervene where there is an excessive use of force. If that wasn't an excessive use of force, then they might as well throw away the book.
In Minneapolis, kneeling on a suspect's neck is allowed under the department's use of force policy. President Trump is threatening social media companies with new regulations or even closure after Twitter added fact checks to two of his tweets. Trump tweeted the claim that tech giants silence conservative voices, quote, "We will strongly regulate or close them down before we can ever allow this to happen." Trump, though, does not have the authority to unilaterally regulate or close social media companies. Trump lashed out on Twitter this morning after the social media platform flagged two Trump tweets that called mail-in ballots fraudulent and predicted that mailboxes will be robbed. Under those two tweets, there's now a link reading, quote, "Get the facts about mail-in ballots," that guides users to a Twitter Moments page with fact checks and news stories about Trump's unsubstantiated claims. Trump said Twitter's action interferes with the 2020 presidential election. As of the last time the Washington Post updated its database of Trump's false or misleading claims, or downright lies, although the Post doesn't call them that, the publication had counted 18,000. That was April 3rd, nearly 2 months ago. President Trump has announced most people on Medicare will have access to prescription plans next year that limit their copays for insulin to a maximum of $35 a month. The announcement is apparently aimed at wooing older people whose votes will be critical to Trump's reelection prospects. At the same press conference where he made the insulin announcement, Trump was asked about his retweet of a Fox News post mocking Democratic challenger Joe Biden for wearing a mask at a Delaware Memorial Day event.
Biden can wear a mask, but he was standing outside with his wife, perfect conditions, perfect weather. They're inside, they don't wear masks, and so I thought it was very unusual that he had one on, but I thought that was fine. I wasn't criticizing him at all. Why would I ever do a thing like that? And your second question was? I couldn't hear you. Can you take it off? Because I cannot hear
you. I'll just speak louder, sir.
You want to be politically correct. Go ahead.
No, sir. I just want to wear the mask.
Biden fired back in an interview on CNN.
He's a fool. An absolute fool to talk that way. I mean, every leading doc in the world is saying we should wear a mask when you're in a crowd. This macho stuff for a guy, well, I shouldn't get going, but it just is, it's cost people's lives. It's costing people's lives. And like I said, we're almost 100,000 dead today.
Thousands of protesters shouted pro-democracy slogans at police in Hong Kong as lawmakers debated a bill criminalizing insults or misuse of the Chinese national anthem. In the Hong Kong Central Business District, police warned protesters to disperse before they shot pepper balls at the crowd and arrested nearly 300. Police warned journalists to stop filming. Opponents of the national anthem legislation call it a blow to freedom of expression in the city. Beijing officials say it will foster a patriotic spirit and socialist values. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now we are going to turn our attention to the ongoing crisis in Haiti. Those of you who follow Sojourner Truth, you know we do quite a bit of coverage in Haiti. Our team has been down there on several occasions. We've recorded a video of recent massacres that took place on the ground there. We were just there, it seems, last year, and bringing this information to you. In Haiti, millions of people are demanding the resignation of the U.S.-backed President Jovenel Moïse. Since coming to office in 2017, thousands of Haitians have been participating in almost weekly protests against his government. Although many of the most recent protests have been limited in number because of COVID-19, but nevertheless, the Haitian people continue to rise up. The women at the marketplace, villagers who have been harassed by the 1% who want to move them off their land, they also took very direct action against that. Haitians have also been protesting the fact that high-level government officials, including the U.S.-backed president put in place with the backing of the U.S., Jovenel Moïse, up to $3.8 billion in Petrocaribe money from Venezuela has basically disappeared, and there has been no accountability. And also, in addition to just protesting the daily grind of extreme poverty, Haiti is the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere. Communities have also been protesting these ongoing massacres. Now, the communities that are supporters of the former president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who remains very popular on the ground in Haiti, the communities that support him are under constant pressure, constant attack, and including the massacres that took place in 2018 in La Saline, Tokyo, and Cité Vincent in the capital. They were targeted. They told us they were targeted because of who they are. The attacks have been very, very brutal. Women and men hacked to death with machetes, bodies burned, and more. Very reminiscent of the Tonton Macoute brutal era of the Duvalier dictatorship. Duvalier, by the way, dictatorship backed and supported by the United States. And now, recently, they in the past few days, including yesterday, these death squad gangs are back in the areas of City Soleil, as well as the area of La Saline. According to a number of reports, gangs of death squads headed by a man known as Barbecue, a former police officer, and others who participated in the La Saline massacre in 2018, again on a bloody rampage, terrorizing the population. On Sunday, May 24th, government affiliated gangs, death squads, conducted mass killings and burned down a number of homes in the impoverished Tokyo neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. This neighborhood was also attacked last April of 2019. While we were on the ground, while we visited there, the number of dead now in this recent round is undetermined at this time. But a number of people are wounded. Houses have been burnt down. And just yesterday, an SOS came from a reporter from alternative media in Haiti about, again, an attacks continuing and homes being burned. What I'd like to do now is to welcome our guest and get her view about what is going on and why. I'd like to welcome Maud Jean-Michel, a well-known organizer in the Haitian diaspora community. She has been the host of very popular radio programs for nearly 20 years. These programs deal with women's rights and concerns, as well as issues of health in minority and immigrant communities. Maud Jean-Michel is an important voice for current events analysis of what is happening on the ground in Haiti. So, Maud Jean-Michel, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Margaret. Good morning to your listeners, and thank you for having me at this crisis moment, because we need everybody's voice. Otherwise, we don't know what would happen right now in Haiti. We don't know.
Right. So what are you hearing on the ground? The description that I gave, and anything else you would like to add to that? What are you hearing, Maud?
You know, what you just described is exactly what's going on right now in Haiti. But the only one thing I would like to add, beside that, those people, they have criminal intent. But there is something else. Something more sinister is hiding behind the actions. It's depossession of these people. It looks like, you know, the same thing that Israel is doing to the Palestinians. This is exactly what's going on. Because most of the time when those people, they flee, they cannot come back to the home. They cannot come back to the place that they used to live. It seems that there is something far sinister going on besides killing these people for political reasons or for who they are. I don't know. They need those people's land, maybe the area where it is, so they could take this place and turn them into something else down the road. I think this is what's going on right now.
Maud, it's interesting you said that, because when I was in City Soleil and La Saline and our team, we were the first international journalists actually that went into the area to speak to the survivors of the massacres. And that area right by the water, right? And, you know, one could just imagine that they want impoverished people off that land, as you just said, and, you know, for their development, for the 1%, and for them to make a bunch of money. And also there were the villagers who were near a beach in another community who were being harassed as well by wealthy landowners who also want that beachfront property. So, That really just underscores your point, Maud.
Thank you, Margaret, for understanding what I was trying to say. Because those people, the way they do things, it's just like what United States is doing to us. They want Haiti, but they don't want us. So the rich people, they are doing the same thing. They want our land without us.
So when without the people, get rid of the people and take the land.
Get rid of the people, because in their mind, those people, they're too dark, they're too ugly, they're not educated. They have a lot of stupid, crazy things they're saying about those people. It's like they're Haitians, but they're living in a farming land, the way they treat them. Anytime they have something and those people want it, they will take it by force. And they were never said, you know what, this area, we can build buildings, we can have business. Okay, let's build homes somewhere else for them, move them nicely. No, they won't do that. They will install fear into their soul so they could just pack whatever they could, or sometimes they just left without anything. They have no time to collect anything. They just have to move in order to save their lives and the children's lives. This is what's going on right now. And then, you know, another thing that gets me so angry, it's the way the press in Haiti, because, you know, we have a corrupt press in Haiti. It's only a few, like Radio Timon and maybe a few others, who are doing something that's honest, that's saying it the way it is. But the other ones, forget it. Each time a massacre took place, in order to hide their action, they're always talking about confrontation between two different gang members, or they always find another word to hide it. And that really gets me angry, because when they talk about confrontation, why it's always one side that we lose people? What happened to the other side? If there was a confrontation, why we don't have people from both sides? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, that is all over the place, because even with the massacres in La Saline that took place, the largest really since the Duvalier days, even in the U.S. Embassy, they were going on about, oh, well, it's just gang warfare between two gangs. But as you're right, it's only one side that is slaughtered in the most brutal way. I do also want to talk to you about the return of this the U.S. threatening to return a death squad leader, Emmanuel Tonto Constant, to Haiti. But before that, the guy who is leading these massacres, and I've heard reports that they came in actually with some armored police vehicles. This guy Barbecue, he is known by the UN. He's known by international human rights agencies. He's known by the government of being involved in these massacres and killing people and helping to orchestrate them. Why do you think he is not in prison? He's still on the street out doing what he does.
So there's no way he's going to get arrested at this moment, because remember, he's doing a dirty job for Jovenel Moïse. Everybody knows.
Jovenel Moïse, the president now of Haiti, U.S.-backed president of Haiti.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So they know who he is. They know where to find him. As a matter of fact, I think you know what happened. I think it was in April. Yeah, I think it was in April. The government was supposed to give some stuff out, like food, soap for those people to wash their hands and little things like that. But instead of the government doing it in an official way, what mm-hmm. they did, they gave those things away to people like barbecue to give to their people. So what was so insulting to it, barbecue had a truck loaded with rice, beans, oil, and different things. And while he is the most wanted right now in Haiti, who was protecting him while giving away the food, Margaret? The police.
Wow. That is quite something. So, in other words, they gave supplies meant for the Haitian people to a death squad leader to distribute while the death squad leader was being protected by the Haitian police.
That's right. You got it.
Unbelievable.
So now tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me. So they know where to find him, how to find him, but they won't do anything to him because he is doing what they told him to do.
Right. And this also, I think there really is a connection with Barbecue's latest activities. And now the U.S. threatening to return a death squad leader, Toto Constant, to Haiti. Tell us who this man is and why there is concern. And also that he is connected with somebody whom Jovenel Moïse appointed to a high position in the newly formed Haitian military. Why the outcry about Toto Constant? Maud.
Okay. Toto Constant is the guy that you wouldn't like to have in your dream. That's a frightful that man is. He was the head of the death squad after the coup took place in 1991. When the
coup against President Aristide, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those people, they were going home to home at night, killed anyone they knew was fighting against the coup, and anyone they knew who used to support President Aristide at that time. So they killed countless of women, raped them. I don't know if you heard about that particular woman. She's always in my mind. I never forget her. It's Alette Belin. When they went to her place, they killed her husband. And they raped her. They beat her. And they tried to cut off her tongue. When they left, they thought that she died, and luckily she didn't. If, Margaret, you saw that woman's face, it will bring you to tears.
Yeah, I believe
what
it. And
that woman's face.
And indeed, Constant, he has been linked to the killings of at least 3,000 supporters of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and as you say, the rape and torture of others. And he fled. He was actually found guilty. He fled Haiti, came to the United States, and broke the law. Got involved in various theft and schemes that where he landed in prison. And now the Trump administration is talking about him being returned to Haiti. And indeed, they threatened to put him on a flight today, yesterday, Tuesday, May 26th.
It was yesterday.
Yeah, but apparently at the last minute, I saw at least one press report this morning to say that that is still on hold, but it's still possible that they will return him. And apparently Jovenel Moise claimed, well, that he called the State Department, you know, to say, well, it may not be a good idea for him to come back now, but that when he does return, he will be granted a new trial, or he could be eligible for a new trial. Your thoughts on that, Maude?
No, he shouldn't even be eligible for a new trial. He should go straight to jail because he was convicted. He should go to jail. I don't think they should waste our money, our tax money, to grant him another trial. He should go straight to jail, because he was found guilty of killing, torturing, raping, so forth and so on. It shouldn't be granted another trial. This is what I think it might be.
Yeah, and also I think that his the threat of his return has also further empowered people like Barbecue, the death squad that are operating now, because, wow, you know, their guy is coming back. And also he has friends high up in the Moise administration. So, the crisis continuing in Haiti. And we're just urging all of you to please go to the Haiti Action Committee website, HaitiSolidarity.net. You can get up-to-date information about what's happening on the ground. Also, you could see links to the videos that the Sojourner Truth team has done on Haiti. We also have links on the Sojourner Truth website at So True Radio. Maude, we're going to have to leave it there, but we do know that Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who stays on the case when it comes to Haiti, she, along with Congressman Levin, wrote a letter objecting to the return of Emmanuel Constant, this death squad leader, to Haiti. So it'll be interesting to find out if the U.S. did not listen to the U.S. Congress people, but if they then listened to Jovenel Moise about the timing. So, Maude, we'll have you back and continue this discussion. Thank you so much for joining us. Any last thoughts you want to say before going?
My last thought would be, please keep doing what you're doing, because our voice needs to be heard.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Maude Jean-Michel. You stay safe and take care of yourself.
Okay. You do the same. Right. Bye-bye.
Okay, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a brief station break, and coming up, our weekly Earth Minute. And then Judy Barry, do you know who she was? 30 years ago, one of the most important environmentalists, brutally attacked and unjustly criminalized. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We who believe in freedom and that
with us. Come on.
We who believe in freedom and that fresh until it comes. To me, young people come first.
They come first.
They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gate.
Secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. We who believe in freedom cannot
to climb.
much for power, not needing the light just to shine on me. I need to be one in the number as we stand against tyranny.
All righty, that's beautiful. Sweet Honey and The Rock. We Who Believe, it's Ella's song is actually the name of it. We always call it We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. What I'd like to do now is go to our weekly Earth Minute.
The coronavirus pandemic is enabling a mass increase in logging globally as criminal groups and illegal loggers take advantage of the disruptions associated with the pandemic. In the month of March, more than 2,500 square miles of forest were lost, mainly in Indonesia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Brazil, an increase of 1.5 times the logging rate over the month of March over 2017 to 2019. Under the ruthless and racist Bolsonaro regime, Brazil's logging surged 171%. The incursion of loggers into indigenous territories in Brazil is causing coronavirus infection among the people, and many fear it will lead to genocide. Adding fuel to the fire, Bolsonaro recently issued a decree to legalize land grabs in indigenous reserves. The decree is awaiting congressional approval. The Guardian quoted Alessandra Munduruku, an indigenous leader from Pará, stating, "The indigenous peoples are alone, and we have to fight against the virus, the loggers, and the wildcat miners. We don't know which is worse." For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org, our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And in the U.S., I'd like to give a shout out to the Sojourner Truth listeners in Centerville, Virginia, a strong following there in Centerville, Virginia. And internationally, let's give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. Yes, we do have SoundCloud listeners there. And now I would like to turn our attention to environmentalist Judy Barry. Just over 30 years ago, she was brutally attacked and unjustly criminalized. On May 24th, 1990, Judy Barry and her partner Daryl Cherney were injured by a pipe bomb explosion in a car they were riding across Oakland, California. Judy Barry was a forest defender, a labor activist, feminist, anarchist, and an organizer with Earth First, campaigning against logging in the Redwood Forest of Northern California. Although both survived the pipe bomb, Judy was left with critical injuries, including a fractured pelvis. And guess what? Law enforcement, instead of figuring out who was responsible for the explosion, well, who knows, maybe they were involved, they claimed that Judy and Daryl basically planted the bomb and therefore bombed themselves. Before we welcome our guests, I'd like you to hear some of that story, hearing the words of Judy Barry herself.
So when the bomb exploded, it was May 24th, 1990, and we were on our way to a concert in Santa Cruz where we were going to play songs and show a slideshow and recruit for Redwood Summer among the college students there. And I can't even describe how horrible it was. I can tell you I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe. But the horror of this experience didn't end with the bombing itself, because within minutes of the bombing, the FBI terrorist squad from the San Francisco FBI office was on the scene, and I literally mean this, within minutes, certainly within a half hour. According to their own records, the first record we have of their being on the scene is a log by the Oakland police, and 25 minutes after the bomb explodes, they recount their conversations with the FBI agents. So they were there pretty fast, considering that this was in Oakland and that FBI office is in San Francisco. And what the FBI did, arriving on the scene immediately, actually my lawyer wrote in the brief, the FBI was there in a trice, almost as if they had been standing around the corner holding their ears. But at any rate, whether or not they were standing around the corner holding their ears, they were certainly there quickly, and what they did was they quickly kind of took control of the scene. And they talked to the Oakland police, who were the responding agency. And what they did is they said to the Oakland police, they said, we know these people. These people are terrorists. And literally what they said, this was testified by Sergeant Sitterud of the Oakland police. He said, they told us that these were the kind of people who would carry a bomb. They told us that
That's the voice of Judy Barry herself, the FBI turning up very, very quickly and claiming that Judy and Daryl were terrorists. I would now like to welcome our guest. Karen Pickett has been involved with forest activism and other ecological and social issues with Earth First and other organizations for 4 decades. She and Judy Barry were close friends and comrades. Karen, I'm so glad you're able to join us. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, the strength of Judy, I mean, clearly after she was injured, she continued our activism. But for our listeners, and particularly for the younger folks who may not know or understand the significance of what Judy was doing, why was she considered such a threat to loggers and even to the U.S. government? What was she doing that caused them worry?
Well, we as Earth First were organizing Redwood Summer, which was to be a summer-long campaign of civil disobedience in the forested regions in Northern California to protest the liquidation logging by the corporations that was going on up there. But Judy, she actually was the principal architect of Redwood Summer in, you know, Earth First figuring out that it was time to do mass organizing. But her background was in labor organizing when she came into Earth First in the late 80s. And so that's what she was grounded in and informed by. And so her analysis was one that had not really been present in Earth First previous to that. And she was giving workshops about, you know, when protesters are out in the woods doing tree sits or whatever, the workshops were how to talk to a logger and, you know, how to bridge that cultural divide and bringing people around to the approach to these campaigns that who the fight was with was the corporations and the CEOs and not the people out in the woods, not the workers, not the loggers. And so previous to that, you know, the workers and environmentalists, which the environmental movement especially then, but still now, you know, was largely white and middle class, and there was this massive divide, and we were organizing kind of in our own camps, and she was bringing these camps together to recognize the common foe, and that's what was dangerous. And not only was it this basic truth that we're fighting the same force, but she was also a brilliant strategist. She was very funny. She was incredibly sharp-witted and irreverent. And so her organizing was very powerful, and that's why she was a danger, and that's why she was bombed.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're going to bring environmentalists and loggers together, which Judy seemed to manage to have done, that's definitely a threat to the bottom line. And also, before this bombing incident, wasn't she? I mean, you're a good friend of Judy's, and wasn't she harassed prior to that? I read somewhere that they tried to like drive her off the road and various other tactics of intimidation. Karen Pickett.
Yes, on working up to Redwood Summer, things were getting very politically hot on the North Coast, and there had been death threats, there had been physical violence, and Judy in particular was targeted in one incident that had been a few months before the bombing, was that she was coming from a demonstration in Mendocino County, and she had her two young daughters and a friend in the car, and they were leaving the demonstration and driving slowly through this small town, and a logging truck came up behind them, and there was a stop, and Judy had stopped and then was going, and the logging truck did not stop, so this massive truck rear-ended her car, and people were injured, though not seriously. It was something that was very scary, and, you know, one has to wonder. They said that it was a mistake, but this kind of thing had been going on, and it was because of what was happening behind the scenes. The PR companies that were working for the timber industry were distributing phony press releases on the Earth First letterhead in timber country, saying that Earth First was bringing violence to the woods. So this was building and building and building, and then the culmination was the bombing.
Yeah, and we just have a couple of minutes left, but just in terms of looking at the environmental movement today and Earth First, I mean, tell us just a bit about Earth First, because it wasn't just Judy and Daryl who were basically being monitored by the U.S. government, but a number of other Earth Firsters as well. And we also know that Earth First then went to Southern Illinois, to the Shawnee National Forest, and participated in the blockade that they were doing to stop the logging that was going on there. So just your final thoughts on the role of Earth First and, you know, just any lessons that could be gleaned from your experience for the environmental movement today. Karen Pickett.
Well, Earth First has always been known as a radical organization, and because we've always pushed the envelope, you know, I don't feel that what we do is particularly outrageous or radical. It's more that it is necessary, because we need to take these risks if we're going to see any change in these systems that need to change. So I think that, you know, Earth First evolves over time, and we've certainly grown with our analysis, but there's always going to be that pushback from the powers that be, from the corporate world, and also from the government. And yes, the FBI and other police agencies had surveilled and targeted Earth First for several years before this bombing happened. Even though that went further, we never thought that something that extreme would happen in response. But just the same, the year before the bombing, the FBI, after doing several years of surveillance, set up they tried to frame some Earth Firsters, including this person who they perceived as the leader of Earth First, and decided that they needed to take him out. And they set up this monkey-wrenching action on the power lines. And the FBI agents were intimately involved with this action. They used a cutting torch on a transmission tower, and they taught the people how to use a cutting torch. They bought the propane. They drove the activists to the site. They helped plan it. This is what the FBI did in order to be able to portray Earth First as terrorists. And that's what they tried to do after the bombing as well, is to say these people are bomb-throwing terrorists.
Right. And for people, you know, let us know about the organization you are working with now, and for people who want to support your efforts. I mean, this is deep environmentalists happening here. So people who are new to the environmental movement or just, you know, kind of getting their feet into activism, what should they do in terms of getting in touch with you all and knowing more about your work?
Well, there's, you know, there's always things that people can do in various situations, and the forest campaigns continue in Northern California, and that's what I'm most involved with. You know, we have a lot of organizing that's going on in the age of the pandemic where people are doing things differently. We have these drive-by demos, but up in Northern California, we actually have a tree sit going on right now up near Eureka, California, where several people are sitting in trees to protest a logging plan by Green Diamond Corporation. And it's something that can be done safely because it's not a crowd of people who are close together. And it was funny. They said, well, they, you know, if the timber companies are going to say that their activity is essential, then we say that protesting this kind of overlogging is also essential activity. So yeah. People can find Earth First, the website and the magazine at earthfirst.news.org, and I also work with the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters, which can be Googled, and we work with the activist groups on the North Coast. But, you know, this activity hasn't stopped, and it can't stop. We just have to figure out how to be creative
okay.
in these very strange times.
Right. Well, Karen, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. I would really like to do something more in-depth about Earth First itself and that whole history and legacy of organizing. I think there are a lot of lessons that could be gleaned from your experience for the younger activists today. So, Karen Pickett, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so Alrighty. Much for having me, Margaret.
Sure. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to turn to our campaigners for Black Lives series. And I would like to welcome our guest today is Dr. Malina Abdullah. She is a campaigner, a founder, one of the founding members of Black Lives Matter LA. She is a professor, author, and community organizer, as well as a mom. Dr. Malina Abdullah, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
Okay. Malina, what we'll do, because there are a couple of things I know you quickly want to talk about. I'm not going to play the video of George Floyd, the latest victim now. He can't breathe. It's like Eric Garner all over again. People have seen that on the mainstream media. I would, though, like to play this short poem called Black 101 and have you respond, Malina.
Black 101. Fear is a magnetizer. It changes the polarity of black bodies, makes them highly attractive to bullets, police batons, tasers, white rage, white guilt, and blue-eyed blondes. Fear is a multiplier. It turns children into men, men and women into monsters, and non-compliant teens into dangerous gangs and threatening mobs. Fear is a magician. It turns hip-hop into gangster rap, plastic toys into guns, cigarillos, cell phones, wallets, brazenness, and extended index fingers into high-caliber weapons. Fear is a revisionist history class. It turns people of color into the enslavers, Confederate soldiers, lynch mobs, Klansmen, night riders, and terrorists. Fear is a sniper. It takes dead aim, aims to kill, kills for sport and pleasure, is pleased to take souvenirs and stuffs and mounts its trophies.
Well, Malina, that poem I thought really expressed the continuum, doesn't it, of the devaluation of black lives and the threat that we all face just leaving the house. I mean, your response to that, because now we have George Floyd. It's almost like a rerun of what happened with Eric Garner. In Minneapolis, we have this white woman in Central Park calling the police on a black man who simply asked her to put her dog on a leash. Then there was Armand, his killing, which was really being chased down and then shot and killed, really a lynching. Melina, your thoughts on this and what we're facing in Southern California, in Los Angeles?
Sure. So the murder of George Floyd, anybody who's seen the video, you can't help but be outraged. But also, if you allow yourself to really feel what's happening, you can absolutely taste the lineage of police as descending from slave catchers. The officer who was sitting on his neck had 10 minutes to make a different choice. You saw people standing around begging for George Floyd's life, some trying to physically intervene and then having weapons pulled on them. And that officer knew he had all power. He knew he had the power to take black life, to steal black life, and he did. And so I think that it's really important that we understand that as we talk about the legacy of policing and why in Los Angeles we're pushing for a divestment from policing, that really what we're seeking to divest from is a system that descends from slave catching, a system that sees black people as non-human, as chattel, as something that has, as people who have no power, not even people who have no power, but beings that they can just steal lives from with no repercussion. And so we saw that in Minneapolis very vividly. And we also need to know that L.A. County Sheriff killed somebody right here in Los Angeles yesterday, right? And we also need to know that Kenneth Ross Jr. was murdered by Gardena police as if he were being hunted like a wild animal. And we also need to know that, you know, Christopher DeAndre Mitchell was murdered in a span of 15 seconds as he was complying with the orders of Torrance PD. So we have to stand up. We have to be outraged by the murder of George Floyd, but we also have to be outraged by the murders that happen right here every day. And so Black Lives Matter is saying, you know, we've done the online protests for the last 2 or 3 months, and it's time to come out of our homes and say enough is enough. So we'll be having an in-person protest today at 4 o'clock in front of Jackie Lacey's office, saying the firing of those officers in Minneapolis is not enough. The elevation of these names is not enough. We want officers here and there to be prosecuted. So that's today at 4 o'clock in front of Jackie Lacey's office at 211 West Temple.
Right. And you all also have a rather comprehensive list of demands, don't you? How can people access them and what can they do to support them?
Sure. So we have a list of black demands, especially given the coronavirus pandemic. We need to remember that, you know, we've talked about disaster capitalism, that this moment is being used by repressive forces to harass, brutalize, and kill black people. So please go to tinyurl.com/blackLADemands to see a list of immediate and long-term demands. Then at 10 o'clock today, here's another action if you don't want to leave your house. We need you to call into the city council meeting, and all of this information is at blmla.org, and it's also on our social media, on Twitter at BLMLA and on Instagram at BLM Los Angeles, as well as Facebook Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. We need you to call into the city council meeting. The mayor of Los Angeles is proposing a budget that allocates 54% of the city's general fund to LAPD. We're saying no way, that we want money for services and resources, not more police who brutalize and kill us.
Right.
That information is at peoplesbudgetla.com.
Okay, Melina Abdullah, a lot going on there. We appreciate you. Thank you for joining us and also for partnering with us for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives series. And we also post a lot of this information on our website. Thank you, Dr. Melina Abdullah. Thank
you. We appreciate you. Thank you, Sister Margaret.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org. Follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Very soon.